Well, I was talking to my daughter Sophia this week, and she was telling me that midterms are coming up. And so I was thinking about tests and testing, and I ran across a poem that I thought I would share with you. It's called "And It Came to Pass." Early in the morning, toward the last day of the semester, there arose a great multitude, smiting the books and wailing, and there was much weeping and gnashing of teeth, for the day of judgment was at hand. And they were sore afraid, for they had left undone those things which they ought to have done, and they had done those things which they ought not to have done, and there was no help for it. And there were many abiding in the dorm who had kept watch over their books by night, but it availed them not. But some were who rose peacefully, for they had prepared themselves the way and made straight the paths of knowledge. And these were known as wise burners of the midnight oil, and to others they were known as the curve raisers. And the multitude arose and ate a hearty breakfast, and they came to the appointed place, and their hearts were heavy within them. They had come to pass, but some to pass out. And some of them repented of their riotous living and bemoaned their fate, but they had not a prayer. And at the last hour there came among them one known as the instructor, and they feared exceedingly. He passed papers among them and went his way. And many and varied were the answers that were given, for some of his teachings had fallen among fertile minds, while other had fallen flat. And some they were who wrote for 1 hour, others for two, but some turned away sorrowfully, and many of these offered up a little bull in hope of pacifying the instructor. Tests. If you've been in school, as you all have, you know what it's like to show up and take a test. As I was reflecting on this, I remember there were two kinds of tests that you're going to encounter as a school student. There's the kind I like and the kind I don't like. The kind I never liked was the memorize information and regurgitate it. That was like the spelling test. Memorize how to spell these words. Or a history test. Memorize these facts and dates about people that you care nothing about. The kind of test, though, that I appreciated was a good math test. Why? Well, because with math, all you have to do is memorize one formula, and you can figure out any of the problems that you encounter, right? One of my fond memories of college was in physics class. We were there, and our professor was a lady who had just come over from Russia. She spoke with a thick accent. We couldn't understand hardly anything she said. And there she stood lecturing us on these complex topics of physics. And as we sat in the class, we encountered a problem that none of us knew how to solve. And the problem was, if a baseball player hits a baseball and the ball leaves his bat at a certain angle and a certain velocity, ignoring wind resistance, how far will it travel before it lands? How many of you know how to do that problem?
No.
Two of you. One of you, because you sat through the last service and I explained it. The answer is that there are a couple variables, and when you have multiple variables and you want to solve the problem, you have to have multiple equations. And the trick to the whole thing was that if you took that angle and split that velocity into two parts, one vertical and one horizontal, you could solve the problem. Because in the vertical plane, we know the acceleration of gravity. It's negative 32.2 feet per second squared, right? They didn't know that at the first service. I had to tell them. So I didn't even ask you guys. But you can figure out how far will the ball go straight up and then straight back down, and how long will that take? And then you apply that to the horizontal portion to figure out where will the ball land? How far will it travel in a horizontal direction? And when I figured that out, there was a light bulb going on. And I went to my friend and I said, "You're never going to believe it. These things are easy. You just have to know how to do it." And I explained it to my friend, and then we told the rest of the guys in the class. And pretty soon we were hoping that all the questions on the exam were about the baseballs, because it was easy once you knew the secret, the trick. But if you don't know the trick, you're going to have a hard time passing the test, are you not? So this morning we're going to look again at the book of Mark, and we're going to find our friends, the disciples. And we're going to see that they're going to encounter two tests this morning. And I'm going to just, spoiler alert, I'm going to give it away right out of the gate. They're going to fail the tests. But I want to make you aware of the test and what they are and that they're coming. And I want you to pass the test. And so what I'm going to do for you this morning, I've worked it out to a simple formula that you can memorize so that when it's time for the test, you can pass the test, all right? So I hope you came ready to think. This might be the last math problem that I give you guys from the pulpit ever. So take notes and pay close attention. It's a good formula, but again, it's going to take a little work to figure it out. So Mark chapter 6, where we left off last week, verse 33. If you were not here last week, we saw Jesus sending his disciples out in pairs, and they went to do ministry for the first time by themselves without Jesus with them. And as they traveled in pairs to do ministry, Jesus gave them instructions for, here's what I want you to do. You're going to go. You're going to depend upon me. You're not going to pack a bunch of extra stuff. You're not going to take a lot of extra money. But you're going to go and you're going to depend on me to give you what you need to do the ministry I'm calling you to do. And then in the middle of this account of them doing ministry, Mark pulls back and gives us one of these Mark sandwich things where he splits it and puts something in the middle. And the part in the middle was about John the Baptist being beheaded, if you'll recall. And it was as if Mark is saying, look, you too are going to go do ministry. You too are going to have to depend on Jesus. And by the way, you're going to have to depend on him in part because you're going to experience persecution just like John the Baptist did. And so we wrapped up, we came back to the story. The disciples returned to Jesus and they were ready to tell him all that they had done and all that they had seen and experienced. If you've done ministry, you can imagine what that's like. They've come back, they're excited, they've got stories to tell, they've seen God at work, and they're kind of on that spiritual high, you might say. But at the same time, they're utterly exhausted from doing things that they've never had to do, from stepping out in faith in ways they never had to step out. And so they're probably spiritually exhausted, mentally exhausted. They've traveled to get back to where Jesus was. So they may even be physically exhausted. And so Jesus says, come on, guys, let's go across the lake. We'll pull back away from the crowd. We'll have a little retreat, just me and you, and we'll debrief from the missions trip, if you will. And then verse 33, that's where we pick up. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. And when he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, this is a desolate place. The hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. But he answered them, you give them something to eat. And they said to him, shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat? I'm going to stop right there. Here's the first test for the disciples. They come across the sea in the boat, escaped the crowd, so they thought. And as they're coming ashore, they notice that there's some people standing around. And as they get closer, they realize there's a lot of people standing around. In fact, we're going to find out in a few minutes, there's 5,000 men, and one of the other Gospels tell us, plus there were women and children too. Thousands of people waiting for them to come ashore. And you can kind of imagine what it would be like. Jesus, I thought we were going to get a couple days off. Jesus, you're going to have to send the crowd away. That's no doubt what we would have been thinking. But it says they came ashore and Jesus looked at the people and what? He had compassion on them. Compassion on them. And he didn't have compassion because they were sick or they had ailments or anything like that. It says he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. They had no one to to lead them, no one to take them to where the food was. They had no one to watch over them and protect them and meet their needs like a shepherd would do for a flock of sheep. You might be sitting there thinking, oh, hold on a minute. There was a high priest in the temple who was responsible for the nation of Israel and leading them in worship to God. There were other priests who also served at the temple. There were Pharisees and scribes and people who taught the people the law. All of these people were in positions of spiritual leadership in Israel. Wouldn't they have been the shepherds? Wouldn't they have taught the people and fed them spiritually? And we learn here, no, they didn't. They didn't. And so when Jesus sees the people and there's no leader, there's no shepherd watching over them, protecting them, providing food for them, he has compassion on them. He begins to meet their needs. No doubt the disciples have seen this happen time and time again as they've followed Jesus and done ministry with Jesus. And it's been a long day and they're exhausted and they were expecting rest and instead they got a large crowd and you can imagine them kind of huddled off to the side as the sun is beginning to set. Hey, Jesus, the people, they need to eat. Look at them. Have compassion, Jesus. They're hungry. You can almost imagine that's what they're saying. Maybe send them away and they can go into the towns and villages around here and buy some food so that they have something to eat. And Jesus looks right back at them and says, why don't you guys feed them? Wait, what? Is that even possible? The disciples, they didn't bring food for 5,000 people. There was just 12 of them and Jesus that were going on the retreat. There's not a Chick-fil-A or any restaurant around where they might buy food. Even if there was a town that had enough food in it, the cost of the food would be astronomical, 200 denarii. They literally look at Jesus and said, Jesus, this is going to cost 20 or 30 grand to feed all these people. We don't have that kind of money. Jesus is asking them to do something, and they don't have the resources to do it. They don't have the food. They don't have the money. I don't think they really wanted to do it. And maybe I'm reading too much of me into the passage. I don't know. But the test was, are they going to feed the people or not? Are they going to feed them or not? Now, I'm going to do something uncharacteristic. I'm going to tell you they're going to fail the test. But before we get to the grading, I want to skip ahead a few verses. Look down at verse 45. Here's the second test. After everything happens, immediately he made his disciples get in the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. Now here's the second test. They get done feeding the people, and Jesus instructs them, guys, get in the boat, and you guys head back where we came from, and I'll catch up and meet you there, but I'm going to dismiss the crowd first. And so Jesus dismisses the crowd and then withdraws to go and pray by himself and then looks and can see the boat. Now, we imagine they probably left around dusk. He no doubt dismissed the people while it was still daylight. And the fourth watch would have been somewhere between 3 and 6 a.m. So they've been busy doing ministry. They come back. They're exhausted, they're wore out, they're ready for a break. They go to take the break and they're met with 5,000 people and they spend the day doing ministry and feeding all of those people. If you've ever been a waitress, imagine waiting on 5,000 people. It probably wasn't an easy task. And then not only that, but Jesus tells them, we're still not going to get our rest here. Get in the boat and head back across. And so they get in the boat and they start rowing across the lake. And as we'll get back to in a minute, they failed their test in the middle of all that. And so they're rowing for hours, looking at the back of the head of the guy in front of them, rowing and rowing and rowing, thinking about the fact that they just failed the test. How's that going? And as they're rowing, it gets dark. And as they're rowing, the wind kicks up. And as they're rowing, the waves are getting bigger and bigger. And the harder they row, the less movement there is. They're not going anywhere. They're still within sight of where they left. And so it says Jesus walks out and is going to walk past them. There's a piece of that that's just funny to me. Look at them struggle. Wouldn't it be funny if I snuck up on them and walked past? But he comes out and he's walking on the water. And imagine what it would be like to be sitting in that boat and you've been rowing for hours and you're exhausted and you're looking out and you think, I think I see something out there on the water. No, it can't be. My mind's playing tricks on me. I'm just really tired. I need to get out of this boat. No, there it is again. I see something. Nudge the guy beside you. Hey, John, do you see something over there? No, there's nothing out here. No, look, over there. And it's dark and the waves are big and every now and then they're catching a glimpse of something. And as it gets closer and it becomes a little more clear, they still can't see clearly. It's still dark, but there's definitely something hovering over the water coming towards them. Now, we know they think it's a spirit. What would you think it would be? I mean, it's easy for us to sit here and say, silly disciples, of course it's Jesus, because we've read this before. But if you're in the boat, you're not thinking at all, Jesus might just come walking past. These guys lived on the lake. They were fishermen. They've never seen anybody walk past. It wouldn't have even been in the realm of possibilities, and so they're convinced it's a spirit of some sort. And what's the reaction? They're terrified. They're terrified. They've been rowing under their own strength for hours, yet they're not moving. Second test. They're going to fail that one too. What about you? Where are you at with the test? You ever find yourself in a position where you feel like you're called to do something, but you're not adequate to the task? Maybe you're volunteering to help with Awana, and you show up on Wednesday night, and you're ready to go, and this one kid comes in and sits in your classroom. And it's the one kid that never pays attention or that always distracts the other kids. Last Wednesday, my daughter Grace was helping with the younger kids. And for an illustration, the teacher had them do a papier-mâché ball. And so they've got flour and water all over their hands. And she said, this one girl, they're taking her to wash her hands, and she walks up to the sink, and she goes like this. And flour and water went everywhere. Have you ever done ministry where it seems like everybody you encounter is just making a mess all over the place? If not, you've not done it enough. But people are hard. And it's easy to talk about kids making a literal physical mess, but you get involved in people's lives and you start to disciple someone and you realize they've got problems. Big problems. Maybe they're struggling with an addiction, or maybe they've got relationship issues within their marriage, or maybe whatever it might be. And you know you're called to minister to that person, help them grow in their faith, yet you also know that there's nothing you're going to ever be able to do that's going to fix that problem. And so what do you do? What do you do? That's the test. Same test that the disciples faced. Jesus, how are we going to feed all these people? We don't have enough stuff to feed them. Jesus, how are we going to make it through the sea? The wind is strong. The waves are big. We've been at it for hours and we've gone nowhere. So the disciples' failures, look back at verse 38, where we skipped ahead. He said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And when they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then he commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them all. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men. First failure. We can't feed all these people. What was the problem? They looked at what they had. They had nothing. And they said, "We're inadequate. We can't do it, Jesus. You're asking the wrong guys." And what's Jesus' response? "Well, what do you have? What can you bring? What can you give? How can you participate?" And they come back and their answer is, "Well, we've got 5 loaves and 2 fish. And just to give you a good picture of this, don't picture like trophy mount on the wall type fish here. And don't picture big, fresh loaves of sourdough bread that are still warm and steaming and smell delicious. Your mouth sweating yet? Picture 5 little pancakes and 2 sardines. That's probably what it was. And as they say to Jesus, "Jesus, here, we took an inventory, and out of 5,000 men and women and children in addition to that, here's what we came up with. 1 little kid's sack lunch. See, Jesus, there's no food." And what does Jesus do? He takes that little boy's lunch and he begins to break the bread. And he gives it to the disciples to start passing out. And he takes the fish and he breaks it up and he gives them pieces to take and begin to pass out to the crowd. Imagine being one of those disciples. You've got a third of a little pancake and a nibble of fish to put on it, and you're walking towards a group of 100 people sitting in a square on the grass. Thinking, "This is really a joke. What did I sign up for?" Yet as you go and begin to hand it out, it begins to multiply and multiply and multiply. And at the end of it, Jesus says, "Now go collect the leftovers." Like there will be leftovers, Jesus. It wasn't enough to fill a kid up. Yet they come back with 12 basketfuls of leftovers. What happened? They failed miserably. Jesus said, "You feed them." And they said, "Not, we can't. Not any way we're going to feed this group of people." But what did Jesus do? He took the little bit that they had and then multiplied it by his power. And it was enough to feed all of them. Enough to feed all of them. Look at the other test they failed. Look down at verse 49. Last part of verse 48, says he meant to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." And he got into the boat with them and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. They carried back a basket of leftovers each, yet they still missed the point. And so the little rowing exercise for hours and hours and hours gave them time to think about that, but they still didn't get it. And when they're struggling and struggling and struggling and getting nowhere, 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 finally Jesus walks up to them and gets in the boat with them, and everything calms. And they're able to row easily across the lake. And it's the same test we face, isn't it? We're faced with those situations where we're ministering to someone else, and over and over we are inadequate to make it happen. And we show up and we go through the motions over and over and over, and nothing ever happens. Nothing ever happens. Nothing ever happens. Mark gives us the next paragraph as a foil for the disciples. The disciples, the ones that were closest to Jesus, the ones that have watched him the most, the ones that should have understood who he was and what he was about, are failing at it. But look at the crowd, verse 53. When they had crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret and moored to the shore. And when they got out of the boat, the people immediately recognized him and ran about the whole region and began to bring the sick people on their beds to wherever they heard him. He was. And wherever he came, in villages, cities, or countryside, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and implored him that they might touch even the fringe of his garment. And as many as touched it were made well. So here's the crowd. The ones that just catch an occasional glimpse, they've heard the stories about Jesus. No doubt they heard about the woman who had the bleeding issue, who just touched the corner of his robe and was immediately healed. And they have faith that the disciples seem to lack. And so they're bringing the sick and they're coming and just hoping he'll get close enough that they can reach out and touch his robe and be healed. And that's a contrast with the disciples who spend all this time with him, yet keep missing the point. They keep missing it. So what do I want you to do today? I want you to act on the empowerment of God for ministry. I want you to act on the empowerment of God for ministry. Now, I promised you a math formula to help apply this and remember it. So here's the formula. When you do ministry and are working with people, you're going to encounter a needy disciple. We'll call our subject of ministry the needy disciple. The person who's got problems, the person who's struggling in life in some way or another and needs help growing spiritually. And the formula is this. Your needy person, we're going to raise that to an exponent. Remember exponents in math? But we're going to do something tricky here. We're going to multiply two things together as our exponent, okay? And the two things that we're going to multiply together, the first one is the inadequate disciple maker. That's you. That's me. That's the person doing ministry. And the other part is God's power. God's power. Now, since we're dusting off the math, let me bring this full circle for you. If we take God's power, and we multiply it by zero. We multiply exponents. God's power times zero. Anything times zero equals what? Zero. So our needy disciple raised to the power of zero. What's anything raised to the power of zero? Does anybody remember? It's one. One. Anything to the power of zero is one. And so needy disciple stays what? A needy disciple, nothing changes. If, on the other hand, we take us not showing up times God's power, nothing happens. Or we show up, but we do it on our own power, so God's power is zero. Same result. It still multiplies and equals zero. Same result. The needy disciple raised to the power of zero is still a needy disciple. It takes both for it to work. It takes us showing up in God's power. That's how God works. That's how God uses us. And so if you're discipling someone, if you're doing ministry, you can't show up on your own and expect God to work mightily in that person's life. You've got to put his power with it. Or if God has put you in this person's life to disciple this person and you don't show up, they're not going to change and grow. Let me give you an example of this and how it works from the Old Testament. My example is going to be Moses. Moses grows up in Pharaoh's household. He knows he's Jewish. He kind of has a sense that his people are being mistreated. And so he decides what? He's going to do something about it. And he goes out, and one day he sees a slave master taking advantage of a slave. And he thinks, I'm going to stop that. Did God tell him to go and stop that? Has God given him his power to lead his people at this point? The answer is no. Moses shows up under his own power with nothing from God, kills the taskmaster, and then what? Has to flee for his life. Has to spend 40 years in the desert. What happens to the slave? Still a slave. Nothing changed. But we fast forward 40 years, and God comes to Moses and says, Moses, I want you to lead my people out of Egypt. What's Moses' response? Been there, done that. Didn't work. Find someone else. No, Moses, it's going to be different because I'm going to go with you. And he shows Moses his power in front of him. And Moses reluctantly goes, and God shows up and demonstrates his power through the plagues. And God rescues his people out of Egypt, and he takes them down to the edge of the Red Sea. And Pharaoh's army is coming. And God says, Moses, lead the people through the Red Sea. And he tells Moses to be involved, doesn't he? Moses, step in and it'll part. Get your staff ready, Moses. What happens if Moses stands up on the bank and says, God, when you part the sea, then I'll know you're telling me to go that way. I'll just stand here and wait. God's power times zero. Nothing's happening. But Moses obeys. He steps out in faith. God's power joins him. The sea splits. The people go through on dry ground. And they go into the wilderness where they wander around for 40 years, but they get there, and what happens? Just like the people in our story. Moses, we're hungry. Moses, feed us. Moses, at least we had food in Egypt. We should have stayed. And God shows up, and God has compassion on them, and God feeds them. And God continues to use Moses to give them water to drink and to make it taste good. Over and over, Moses shows up in faith. God's power multiplies by it. And we see God do mighty, miraculous things for his people and through his people. And it's the same thing for you and for me. That's the formula. And so when you're called to come and do ministry in some way, whether it's serving in a church or teaching a class or discipling someone one-on-one, and you're sitting there thinking, I don't feel like I have what it takes, or I'm exhausted, I don't have any more energy, or that guy's messy and there's a lot going on in his life and I don't know how to deal with all that stuff. That's where the test starts. And so the question is, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Are you going to pass the test, or are you going to be like the disciples and say, Jesus, we don't see how it comes together, we're out. And what I'm trying to challenge you with today is to pass the test. You show up, say, God, I don't have what it takes, but that's okay because you're an all-powerful God. And I'm confident, just like you used Moses, and we could go back all through the Old Testament and even through the New Testament and look at all the people that God used in different ways. And they showed up, and God did remarkable things in and through them. We serve the same God, and he works the same way. And so when he says, hey, I want you to do this, I want you to serve in this way, disciple this person, lead this ministry, whatever it might be, it's okay to say, I don't have what it takes. The reality is none of us do. But we step out in faith and God shows up. And it's God's power that makes all the difference. I stand up here and see you guys sitting there and see people sitting in the first service. And over, I remember stories of having conversations with different ones of you. And sitting there thinking, I have no idea what to tell this person. But I sat there and God showed up. And you guys are the stories of God's faithfulness. As over and over, lives changed and marriages were healed and people trusted Christ and on it goes. And all I did was in my inadequacy showed up and allowed God to use me. He wants to do the same for you. So will you pass the test? Will you step out in faith and willingly acknowledge that you don't have what it takes, but recognize that God does, and go ahead and put a foot out and let him carry you through? Because that's what it takes to pass. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father God, thank you for all that you've done for us. Thank you that you invite us to participate in what you're doing. Father, my prayer is that as we continue on, that we would be people who rely on you, who trust you, who willingly step out in faith, because we've met you and experienced you and watched you carry us through. Father, my prayer is that you would use us in mighty ways to love one another, to love the people of Woodstock, to introduce them to your Son, and that your kingdom would be expanded because we stepped out in faith. God, provide your power. It's in your Son's name that we pray. Amen.